It's Philosophy Talk.
Nonviolent resistance is the most powerful weapon that oppressed people can use in breaking loose from the bondage of oppression.
What can nonviolence really achieve in a violent world?
What do we do when we hate? What do we do when we feel massive aggression?
Our guest is renowned cultural critic Judith Butler.
Do we simply act on it or act it out? Or are there ways to cultivate aggression into nonviolent tactics? What's the aim of a revolution? What's the aim of radical action? We want to build a different kind of world than the one that we live in. We want to build a less exploitative world, a less violent world, and we have to start to enact the principles that we hope to realize.
The art of nonviolence.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Hi, philosopher. Thanks for downloading this episode of Philosophy Talk.
And thanks so much for being a partner in Philosophy Talk. Now, you've supported us in the past, and we're really grateful for that. But we need your help now more than ever. We need your help to make more of what we know that you love.
So here's how you do it. You go to our website, philosophytalk.org, and click the I Will Help button. It will really help.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for thinking.
And thank you for donating. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Marsh Theater in Berkeley, California.
Our thinking originates at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus across the bay. That's where Ken teaches philosophy. I taught there for 40 years. Right now, I'm a visitor here at Berkeley.
And we'll try not to hold that against you, John. Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Now, today, we're thinking about the art of nonviolence.
Well, it's good that you call it an art, because it definitely must be an art. The trick is knowing when and where it will actually work, if ever.
Yeah, it works just about everywhere it's been seriously tried, John. I mean, nonviolence brought down apartheid in South Africa, Jim Crow in the United States, and British colonialism in India. It works.
Yeah, but it took violence to defeat the Nazis, Ken. It took violence to end slavery, and it took violence to free America from the British tyranny. So you got to admit, nonviolence has its limits.
I don't have to admit any such thing. I don't admit any such thing. Look, violence just begets more violence. Only nonviolence can break that cycle.
Well, tell that to those poor students who were mowed down by the Chinese government in Tiananmen Square. Where did the nonviolence get them? Dead.
Yeah, but John, they did not die in vain. Their cause is seared in the memories of everybody who was alive at that time. I'm sure you remember those images. Their courage and sacrifice helped open our eyes, the eyes of the whole world, to the true nature of the Chinese regime at that time. It was pretending to be liberalizing, but they opened our eyes to the truth.
Did we need Tiananmen Square to learn that? Everybody knew that.
But suppose that they had opted for armed resistance. Just imagine. What do you think would have happened?
It would have been a nightmare. A lot more people would have died. The government would have been able to hide behind claims of needing to preserve and protect civil order.
Yes, exactly. So now you're beginning to appreciate, I think, the real advantage of nonviolence over violence.
What's that?
Moral clarity, John.
Oh, okay. Well, could you clarify moral clarity for me?
Yeah, because nonviolence can achieve a degree of moral clarity that violence can never, ever hope to. Think of those civil rights protesters on that bridge in Selma being beaten by those racist cops with the whole world watching. The whole world. Under those circumstances, a person of goodwill had no choice. They had to stand with the protesters. Now, if those protesters had turned violent instead, the moral clarity of that moment would have been completely lost.
You know, that's all well and good, Ken, but you're assuming that there's people of goodwill off in the rafters waiting to have their consciousness awakened. But that's not always true. What if it's false? What if most people have made their peace with a system that is corrupt through and through? If they're willing to do anything to defend it and hold on to their power and privilege, what then?
Still, nonviolence is the answer. Because then you take a page out of Gandhi's book. You make the system completely unworkable. You put body and soul in its way. You disrupt its economy, tie up its police force, clog up its jails, overburden its courts. But you do all of it nonviolently.
Nonviolence works sometimes. It worked in India because the Brits by that time were exhausted and they didn't have the stomach for more brutal oppression. Put body and soul in the path of oppressors who are more determined, who are made of sterner stuff, and you'll just get crushed bodies and souls.
Well, I'm not going to deny that nonviolent resistance might not give a psychopathic tyrant like Hitler or Pol Pot, it might not give them the slightest pause. But I still think that even in such circumstances, it can send a morally clarifying message to those who side with that tyrant out of nothing but fear and intimidation. You can say, this is what you side with.
Effective resistance isn't Twitter. It isn't sending messages. It's ending oppressive systems by replacing them with systems that are more just. And sometimes, all I'm saying, sometimes that takes violence.
Yeah, but there's a false dichotomy in the background, John. Oppressive systems fail when people of goodwill stand their ground and make them fail. The moral clarity of a nonviolence resistance, you know what it does? It invites all people of goodwill, stand here together. Violence almost always drives people apart, even people who might otherwise be allies. You got to admit that.
Well, look, Ken, I don't want you to think I'm eager for more violence. I'm all for nonviolence when it works. More love, sweet love, that's what the world needs now. All I'm saying is we won't get it without a little armed insurrection here and there to sweep away some bad actors along the way. To quote our beloved former vice president, all I'm saying is give violence a chance.
John, okay, come on. I admit that you're certainly not alone in thinking that nonviolence isn't always the answer. I mean, during the civil rights era, for example, the choice between violence and nonviolence, it actually sharply divided people who were equally devoted to the cause of improving the lives of black people. So we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shuka Kalantari, to re-examine that debate. She files this report.
It's 1972. Black Panther activist Angela Davis is in a California state prison. A journalist visits Davis behind bars and asks her, "What do you think about violence?"
When you talk about a revolution, most people think violence, without realizing that the real content of any kind of revolutionary thrust lies in the principles and the goals that you're striving for, not in the way you reach them. On the other hand, because of the way this society is organized, because of the violence that exists on the surface everywhere, you have to expect that there are going to be such explosions. You have to expect things like that as reactions.
You need to disperse immediately. If you are in the middle of the street, you are unlawfully assembled, you will be subject to arrest. Do it now.
This idea of violence and nonviolence is, we're not looking at it through the lens of the people that are experiencing the governmental violence.
That's Erica Huggins, a professor at Laney College in Oakland, California, and a former member of the Black Panther Party.
We live in a country that built its economic system on the owning of humans. I can't think of anything more violent. And so you can't expect that people will walk up to the door of those stakeholders of violence and say, "Will you stop it, please?" And then they do. They do not. So at some point, people make it their business to defend themselves from that violence.
This desire to defend herself led Huggins to join the Black Panther Party when she was 18 years old. It was 1969.
I decided to leave the Lincoln University campus in Pennsylvania where I was and drive across the country with John Huggins to join the Black Panther Party.
John Huggins was Erica's husband. Later that year, he was killed during a protest at UCLA, allegedly by the FBI. Erica was pregnant at the time. Soon after, she moved to New Haven and became a leader in the Black Panther movement. A few years after that, she was charged with murder and spent 2 years in prison, mostly in solitary confinement. Those charges were later dismissed.
It isn't that the Black Panther Party said or thought nonviolence is not good enough. The principles that Martin Luther King studied from Mahatma Gandhi. It's beautiful and wonderful. And for the sake of love of the people, the Black Panther Party was formed. It's just that we also felt that we should defend ourselves if we're attacked.
Huggins says the Black Panther Party was created because African Americans were being lynched, beaten, and killed on a daily basis.
And some of that has stopped so that it looks like we're in a different era. And I think we buy into that. We believe that it's different because it's more submerged in a way, but it's still there.
It's not that submerged. In 2014, over 24 unarmed people of color were killed by police. In 2015, the U.S. Attorney General came out with a report showing years of police bias in Ferguson, Missouri.
Ferguson is not new. St. Louis has been that way ever since St. Louis was St. Louis. So we're always, the big we, is always shocked when the people stand up for their rights. Why are we so shocked?
Huggins says the Black Panther Party was about dismantling systems, not harming individuals, but harming the systems that brought harm to them. Today, Huggins is a sociology teacher. She says there's hope. If states create regulations about how police officers behave, and if they have proper training, then maybe we can have real justice and real peace. Until then, Erica Huggins will continue to dismantle systems. But now, she'll do it from inside an Oakland classroom. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
Thanks, Shuka, for that piece that reminded some of us of things we remember and others of us a history lesson. I'm John Perry. I'm here along with my fellow philosopher at Stanford, Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Marsh Theater in Berkeley, California.
Our guest today is a professor of comparative literature, also here at UC Berkeley. She's a very prolific and influential author, and pertinent to today's topic is her piece, Interpreting Nonviolence. Please welcome to the Philosophy Talk stage, Judith Butler.
So, Judith, tell us, was there some firsthand experience, some event in your life that convinced you of the power of nonviolence?
Well, I don't know if it was a single event, but it is true that I grew up in high school and junior high, actually, during the civil rights movement, and there were some active debates going on, even among high school students at the time, whether violence was a good tactic and what the risks were. How did we understand nonviolence? What was its importance? And then I suppose by the time I got to college, I was more explicitly part of the feminist movement and active in feminist self-defense training, martial arts for women, a really important practice that helped us to imagine we could walk the streets of urban America at night.
Well, nonviolence, we've all got to admit, is a pretty good thing. And we probably should all admit it's a first resort. Violence should be the last resort. But isn't it just wishful thinking to suppose that we can always bring about change nonviolently?
Well, I don't know if we can always bring about change nonviolently. I don't think the proponents of nonviolence say that we can always achieve change that way. There may be a limit to how we can achieve change under the best of circumstances. So achieving change all the time through tactics of nonviolence is probably not so important. I mean, maybe what's more important is to figure out how we want to live and what kind of world we want to live in, and what do we mean by nonviolence anyway? Do we always know what's nonviolent and what's not?
Well, yeah, to take that issue, I mean, some people accuse the civil rights movement of violence because they deliberately, I mean, Martin Luther King said this, they've deliberately provoked violent reaction from the police. They counted on Bull Connor beating them, right? But they counted on the cameras being there when it happened, too. So they set out and some people said, well, that itself is a form of violence. That's like provocative nonviolence.
Well, it's interesting. I actually don't think you can make another person do violence to you? In other words, what do we mean by provocation? I mean, yes, if I show up at a demonstration where there are police and where they're angry or where the stakes are really high, it's true that like the likelihood of violence happening is escalated, right? We can say that. But the policeman, the state authority who beats you, is finally responsible for that action. They're the violent one. That's where the violent action happens. I don't think we can say that those who set it up or provoke are part of the violent action. I don't actually believe that.
I think although Martin Luther King said those things in that particular situation, it's not intrinsic to nonviolence that it provoked violence. I mean, for example, strikes by labor unions are a form of nonviolent activity. And sometimes they provoke violence, but that's usually not the aim. The aim is to inconvenience people and to cut into profits. So nonviolence is a technique that sometimes may lead to violence, and maybe sometimes that's necessary, but it's not part of the strategy.
So we'll have to take that one up deeper after.
Yeah, let's hope so.
This is Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Mars Theater. Our guest is Judith Butler from UC Berkeley, and we're thinking about the art of nonviolence.
Nonviolent resistance movements have had many successes around the world, but are there limits to what nonviolence can achieve? Or there are times when violence is the only option? If someone attacked and brutalized those who you hold near and dear, would you turn the other cheek or seek to extract bloody revenge?
Confronting the choice between violence and nonviolence, along with questions from our audience, hopefully nonviolent audience, please, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Thanks to our musical guests, the Playtones. This is Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Judith Butler from UC Berkeley, and we're thinking about the art of nonviolence.
Are we morally required to refrain from violence whenever we can, or are we morally entitled to meet an aggressor's violence with violence of our own? Join the discussion by stepping up to the microphone in front of the stage.
So, Judith, I want to give you a chance to respond to John's last point, because you seemed like you really wanted to get at it.
Well, let's put it this way. If someone were to say women who walk the streets at night are provoking rapists, or a trans person who walks down a homophobic, transphobic, in an urban center or a non-urban center that's known for its homophobia or transphobia, do we hold that person responsible for an attack? Do we say they've provoked the attack? In the same way, if a number of people who are defending civil rights in Birmingham or Selma, or indeed in Oakland, let's not get too far away here, are amassing together and some commentator says, oh, well, they're provoking police violence, do we accept that use of the word provoke? Do we think that's blaming people who suffer violence for the violence done to them?
Well, I take your point. And if you say provoke in a morally toned way, I think you're exactly right, that that's a misuse. But if you say, like, they planned on, the woman walking down the street does not plan on the rapists, right? But sometimes the civil rights movement did plan on the police being violent, and that was crucial to their plans because they wanted to just reveal who these folks were. I mean, John said resistance isn't about sending messages, but sometimes it really is. It is a communicative act. Don't you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, the problem is that if you seek to demonstrate that the police are regularly violent, then people can come back and say, oh, see, they brought on the violence of the police. They are responsible for the violence of the police. And my sense is that we can't really separate that argument from its moral tone.
Yeah. So let me ask you another kind of question. So in the piece from Shuka,
yeah,
the Black Panthers kind of positioned themselves as a defensive movement. Violence in response. They weren't really out for violence. They were out for revolutionary change, but they were in this violent context, and sometimes they had to be violence in return. If someone brutally attacks my loved ones, let's just as a fact, I'm not going to turn the other cheek. Mm-hmm. I'm going to do my level best to stop them. I'm going to do my level best to stop them by any means available to me, including violent means. Mm-hmm. So do you see anything morally wrong with that kind of response to violence when it's started by others?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that much of this discussion depends on whether we can distinguish meaningfully between legitimate self-defense and violent aggression.
Right.
And if you're trying to stop or block violent aggression, it seems to me you use force. And that's a tactic. I mean, nonviolence is a tactic that takes place in a field of violence, right? Nonviolence only becomes an issue, a problem, a possibility, because there is violence all around, and right, you're trying to figure out how to deal with this violence in which you're living. I mean, so let's understand that violence is already in the scene, and I think that's both what Angela Davis and Erica Hutchins were saying, and that's really important. But let me just say this, that of course you try to block that violence, but that's blocking violence is different from retribution, taking revenge, trying to expunge the other or use the same kind of force or the same kind of aggressive tactics in return.
Help me understand that difference. I think I have a feel for what you're getting at, but help me understand that difference.
Well, I do think if the blow is coming from outside and against you from an external authority and you seek to block it, and let's say you seek to block it against those you love as well, how do you block it without becoming as violent as the one you are seeking
right
to stop? So then the question is...
That's the hard question.
That is the hard question, and it's a tactical question. And we can't answer it in the abstract. It's kind of, it's more like a guideline that we use. Like how, and it's why nonviolence is more often a tactic than an absolute principle.
So, I mean, lots of times, the reason it's a good tactic or the reason it's the best tactic is because there is just overwhelming force on the other side. I mean, Thomas Jefferson said we should have a revolution every 25 years in America, and sometimes the NRA thinks he was thinking about guns. I don't know what he was thinking about, but I think we should have a revolution, but it's got to be a nonviolent revolution. I mean, I think we should be having sit-ins, we should be having marches about all sorts of things, the incarceration of people, the way that congressmen take money. There ought to be a lot more nonviolent protests, but violent protests against the American government, totally, completely asinine and hopeless, right?
Well, it really depends here again what your end is. What's the end that seeks to be achieved? It's interesting to me that Angela Davis now, in the wake of Ferguson, says we need to lay down guns. Mm-hmm. Guns are not the way to go. And she's been asked very explicitly, does this mean you've changed your view from what it used to be? And she says, yes, I have changed my view. And what's the reason that Angela Davis has changed her view? Because she's trying to think about the world we are trying to build. In other words, what's the aim of a revolution? What's the aim of radical action? It's we want to build a different kind of world than the one that we live in. We want to build a less exploitative world, a less violent world, and we have to start to enact and to have, as part of the means of our action, the principles that we hope to realize.
So, but, okay, I get that. And it sounds good. And I was the advocate of nonviolence as often as possible.
Yeah, but I'm losing you.
And, but, because of the following thing. The civil rights movement was a high point in moral clarity and organization from below. It was a great thing. It rewrote the laws in a Senate and Congress that was still dominated by, you know, the Dixiecrats and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's a great thing. But, you know, immediately after the civil rights movement, because of complicated things, the prison industrial complex in the United States started to grow and deepen and imprison millions of black men for things that in most of the world people aren't, and for a long time and all this. We have more people in prison. Right, we went from slavery to Jim Crow to this brief shining moment, but right after this prison industrial complex, which I think of as personally the new civil rights movement.
Yes.
I mean, we left the power structure. We changed the law, but we really left the old power structures, the old divisions. They were still in place, and they worked their magic through the mechanisms of the U.S. government. I could hear somebody saying, see, it was incomplete because It was too much presuming what John said that I was presuming. People of goodwill watching that just need their consciousness awakened, but didn't really understand the real dynamics of power and interest. And what do you think about that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's a question whether the civil rights movement ever did come to an end or whether it's still happening. I think the civil rights of black people and people of color more generally in this country continue to be a really crucial issue. So we're still in that struggle. And when we are looking now at police violence and prison violence, right? The violence of the prison as an institution, that's one thing. And then the actual violence that the prison does to those who are detained there and incarcerated, that's a second thing. What's the response to that violence? How do we expose the institutional and violent power of the prison system now, which so clearly and disproportionately targets the black population in the United States? Well, it seems to me that hunger strikes are a great example of within prisons. I mean, there was a fabulous hunger strike in Pelican Bay among those who are in solitary confinement. Like, how did that get organized, you know? But it did get organized. And actually, there was a solidaristic group in Palestine, also in solitary confinement, that did the exact same thing at the exact same moment. It's like, great, let's bring attention to the global dimension of the prison industry and its and the violence that it does. It's true that we need a media that's willing to pay attention. We need a media that's not going to report this in some way that undercuts it. And all events of these kinds, indeed all consequential nonviolent events, require a media that can and will interpret it in certain ways. There's no question.
But let me try to pose a fundamental moral problem. I mean, oftentimes it's a small group of individuals who may not necessarily be violent people, but are really the cause of widespread problems. Just hypothetically, suppose I were convinced that the real problem is the Supreme Court, which pays no attention to the Eighth Amendment, barring cruel and unusual punishments. And I've got two plans. One is to organize a protest in front of the Supreme Court, but the other is I figured out a way to assassinate a couple of them.
He's not advocating that. It's a hypothetical.
This is hypothetical. Now, I'm not, you know, we're talking about people, hypothetically, are causing great amounts of harm. If you don't like the Supreme Court, pick another target. Is there some real moral argument that says if the assassination and the protests each have a 50-50 chance of working, that there's something really wrong about assassinating these corrupt, powerful,
yes, there is,
evil-producing people?
Well, the problem is that you've got a kind of really narrow means-ends framework that you're using. Like, oh, let's change these laws that the Supreme Court won't change, say. And how do I do that? Do I protest or do I assassinate? And my view would be, actually, what kind of larger world do you want? Do you want a world that minimizes police presence and that starts to diminish the violence exercised by police and military powers over our daily lives, including the daily lives of those in prison? If that's your general goal, then the question is through what means do you want to achieve that? And your assassination will only bring on more and more police power.
No, but I'd say, well, you're one of these big picture people. You're always thinking about far goals. But I think real life is like, here's an injustice. This shouldn't be going on. Can I stop that? Can I improve things here and now for a couple of years?
Yeah, just said it was a system. You didn't say it was this or that. You said it's a whole system. Yeah. I have to think systemically. That's what you told me.
And I'm on Judith's side here. I'm on Judith's side here.
No, I mean, okay. Come on. That's not fair. I mean, realize, I'm being the devil's advocate here. So you know.
You have to be a consistent devil.
Yeah. I'm sitting in the State Department one day, back a few years. I'm watching Cheney completely corrupt the United States, get us into trouble. He doesn't know the difference between a Shiite and a Sunni, and he's going to go in and solve all these problems.
Right.
And I see his pacemakers being recharged. Right? Now, I mean, why not?
Well, because...
because in the long scheme of things, no. Do you want to live in a world where people can't trust that their pacemakers will be recharged?
No,
that's not it. Here, right now, why not? What's wrong with violence?
Because I think you said the fundamental thing. The means that we have deployed to achieve our ends, they really do set like a precedent for what kind of world, how we are going to relate to one another. The civil rights movement wanted the American consciousness to outlaw segregation. They weren't just like trying to force people to. They wanted to rely on the consciousness of the goodwill of many people to say, here's the truth. Now, what world do you want to live in? Right? Here is the truth in your face. That's what nonviolence can do. It can say, here is the truth. It's not just a Machiavellian thing operating behind the scenes to bring about whatever end by whatever means. So I think I totally agree with you. And I think where nonviolence is successful, it is so powerful just because, right, it does this thing.
See, but maybe this isn't the issue of nonviolence, but I'm in favor of change, but I don't think you have to work for change because you've got some starry idea about what the future of the world is going to be like. I think you just have to have some starry idea about what you want the city council in Palo Alto to be like, or what you want, if you want the Supreme Court to quit saying stupid things. I think the idea of working for change with this long-range vision can sap the energy out of a lot of people because the long-range vision isn't going to happen.
I think if we look at some of the major mass demonstrations that have been happening in the last even just 4 to 6 years, there have been mass demonstrations most recently against police violence, especially police violence against black men and some black women as well. There have been massive demonstrations against capitalism and its excess, the Occupy movement. There have been massive demonstrations against authoritarian rule. There have been massive demonstrations against austerity politics in much of Europe, in massive demonstrations in favor of public education in Chile, in Montreal, and here in Berkeley as well. These are big picture issues that are getting people out in the street. And every time we're out in the street, and every time we're in a highly networked and important movement that's gaining enormous amounts of attention and more and more people are participating, we have a question of by what means do we proceed? Okay, and I think means matter. I don't think we can achieve any of those goals, economic equality, anti-racism, we can't achieve any of them if we go by the banner by any means necessary. I'm not in favor of that.
No, I agree with, look, but there is this, because John said something in the opening that I think is true about the civil rights movement, about many nonviolent movement. It depends on their people on the sideline of goodwill, good conscience, whose consciousness to be aroused and who need to be spurred into action and who need to see the truth clearly. Okay, but there are systems in which you're resisting and all about you are like Hitler's willing executioners.
Yes.
Right? And so when you try nonviolent means in a context like that, it may come to a standstill.
Yes.
And the only possibility is a more determined kind of resistance. I mean, do you agree with that?
Well, you know, I mean, I grew up in a Jewish household. Most of my grandmother's family was exterminated, and those are the stories I had. And many of my early lessons in ethics at the synagogue posed the question, would you collaborate with the Nazis if it meant saving your life? And most of us agreed we would not collaborate, even if it meant saving our lives, that we would rather die not collaborating.
Right.
So sometimes, you know, living is important, and self-preservation is important. I don't mean to underestimate it, but but one does have to live in a way that one can live with, right? And at a certain point, your principles do matter.
And so even if you face overwhelming odds, you resist with your every last breath, with your
power. I think you live and die with your principles.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about nonviolence, the art of nonviolence, with Judith Butler from UC Berkeley.
In our final segment, we'll ask about ways to spread nonviolence.
We're coming to you from the Mars Theater in Berkeley. We'll take more questions from our live nonviolent audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Kill without a trace. Stick a finger up his nose and pull it off his face.
We'll pull his teeth right out and sell the silver plate.
We're gonna stamp out hate.
Thanks to our musical guests, the Playtones, I thought there was a hint of irony in that. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Judith Butler from UC Berkeley. And we're thinking about the art of nonviolence in front of a live audience at the Mars Theater. We've got questions from that audience. Can't really see who's out there. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hey, thank you. I'm Matthew, and I'm from Oakland, California. I guess my question is pretty fundamental, and it concerns what we mean by nonviolence. We were talking a little bit earlier about how accusations against sort of nonviolent protests have been made, characterizing them as violence. And one of the things that we were discussing, or one of the ideas, was that, like, that these protests were violent because they attempted or they intentionally provoked police violence. Also, that the very nature of these protests are more intentionally disruptive. And so the Occupy protests were blocking, people getting to their jobs and were costing New York City, millions of dollars in revenue and, costing the taxpayers money as they had to. And you're hearing that as well with the blocking the freeways, the die-ins on the 580. Somebody might be having a heart attack or something. So it's only what the kind of narrative I feel like I'm hearing is something like, it's only to be expected that the police are going to have to react in this way, in a violent way, in order to contain a disruptive protest, in order to save lives, if people are blocking the freeways, et cetera, et cetera. So I guess what I'm asking is what we mean by nonviolence, especially when now the charge is that these protests are violent because they disrupt a system and actually have violent consequences.
You raised the question yourself. What do we mean by nonviolence? So they didn't really answer.
Well, let me just say this, that if you read Gandhi or you read Gene Sharp or you read nonviolent protocols that have been established for a long time, blocking transportation and stopping business as usual is a nonviolent tactic. Strikes are a nonviolent tactic. They do hurt the economy. They keep people from getting home at night. They produce an enormous inconvenience. But it's a way of saying no business as usual, and it's a nonviolent tactic. It has consequences, affects the economy, etc. But it's not a violent tactic.
Yeah, one of the things you can't lose sight of, thanks for the question, one of the things you can't lose sight of is that nonviolent protests and demonstrations and nonviolent tactics they're not intended to leave things as they are. They're not like, oh, there's the nice people walking in with signs. They're supposed to disrupt. They're supposed to be coercive. They're kind of, you could call them power plays of a certain kind, right? Because they're trying to change things. You don't change things just by marching around and being peaceful. Oh, they march over there. That won't bother us.
But if you obstruct, say, the daily life of capitalism, or you obstruct the daily life of the police, you're actually keeping those mechanisms that are arguably violent from continuing to operate.
Right. That's the idea. Another question. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, ma'am.
Hello, my name is Linda, and I'm from both Berkeley and Stanford.
All right, a divided consciousness. Anyway,
In many discussions about nonviolence I've had, both in the classroom and elsewhere, there are certain red herrings that keep getting raised and that you have also raised that I want to point out and get your comment on. One of them is somebody always says right at the beginning, well, it wouldn't have stopped Hitler. And then somebody says, well, it's just about morality. And then there was another red herring, which I've just forgotten what it was. But anyway.
3-2 is pretty bad.
I remember. It's yours, John, and that, or your devil advocate one, which is it ever moral to fight back violently against somebody who's doing violence? And these questions are asked as if everything depends. If you can't answer that with the right answer, like, yes, it's sometimes moral to be violent, or yes, it wouldn't have stopped Hitler, then it's finished. Then the nonviolence people have to shut up. Mm-hmm. That's wrong. That's mm-hmm. a diversion of the argument. Mm-hmm. The real question is, how can we expand the scope of nonviolence, and why is it that the state, the society, and our educational institutions put practically zero investment in developing knowledge and sophistication about the possibilities of nonviolence?
Well, let me just say,
Take that, John.
Yeah. I completely agree with the thing you said at the conclusion. I mean, nonviolence is that's why I object a little to putting it always in these terms of improving the world. Let's just improve Berkeley, get the tuition down at the University of California. Let's stop gerrymandering by sitting in on state representatives who vote for that. It is a technique that should be taught, not as some kind of cosmic cure-all, but as an ordinary way that people in a country with free speech and the right to assemble ought to be trying to influence their idiot leaders.
No, that's a deep point. I think that's a really good point. Look, we want our young people to grow up to be engaged citizens. One of the schools teach you about voting and all that sort of stuff, and they tell you about these great historical movements. But engaged citizenry means sometimes resisting outside of the normal realm of politics by these means that engaged citizens throughout history have used to change. And that doesn't have to be an act of hate or something like that. It can say, here, I'm trying to move you, my fellow citizens, so that we change our lives together. You're nodding.
Yes, I mean, I think Linda's question is a really good one. And I think those who try to find these exceptional moments that are very hard to argue about are imagining that nonviolence is a rational system. They're not understanding that it's a set of principles that we seek to embody as best we can. And like most of our principles, we sometimes fail. We sometimes succeed, or we figure ways to realize them better and better. It's a practice. It's a principle in action. It's a practice that we seek to realize over time. And it's also a way of thinking about the world and what kind of world we would prefer to live in.
It's a practice. Is it a practice that we know how to teach? I mean, is it a practice like... I mean, there are many practices with lore and a history and a tradition and practitioners and apprenticeships. Is this a practice that we actually know how to...
Well, I don't know if we know how to teach it. I do know that every time I teach a Greek tragedy, it comes up, because so many Greek tragedies depend on something horrible happens by virtue of retribution, and it raises the more general question: what do we do when we hate? What do we do when we feel massive aggression? Do we simply act on it or act it out, or are there ways to cultivate aggression into nonviolent tactics? Is there a way to work with one's hate so that one doesn't end up replicating the enemy one is resisting? Because once that happens, we've lost the battle.
So one way we could teach it and research it is to take a question like, could nonviolence have stopped Hitler? Well, you say, of course not, because he had the whole... But it took a long time for Hitler to get where he was. Was there a point at which nonviolent techniques could have worked or could have made a difference? That's an interesting theoretical question, and if we got people to think about that, they would see more of the possibilities of change. I mean, people in America right now are very lethargic and depressed about the hope of changing things like Congress. It's easy, given the nonviolent tools we have, if we just get organized, which I hope one of you will do.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hi, my name's Adam. I'm from Oakland. And I was in Iraq for the invasion in the first 11 months, and so I had the opportunity to exist in a system where violence was the only option. Whether you wanted to do right or wrong or anything, all you had was violence or recourse to violence. So my concern now in trying to translate that into this experience, into the rest of my life, is in a structure, in a system where violence is its language. Violence is how it operates, right? Our power systems here in this country anyway. If you practice nonviolence, do you actually have a language or a voice within that system? If the only thing that the system understands is violence, and therefore it also relies on obedience, or it relies on your nonviolence and interprets that as obedience, is nonviolent practice actually just interpreted or read as mm-hmm. obedience?
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for your remark. I appreciate your offering it to us today. I want to say this. I'm not sure there's just one system. I think that's the question that's before us. Can we open up another way of thinking? Is there, within this ostensible system that only knows the language of violence, are there also many languages and practices of nonviolence that we can point to that are constantly challenging that? I think we have to make sure that system of violence that you name doesn't become closed so that we can't think outside of it or against it.
I want to really second what you just said, because I don't think we can, people of goodwill who want to resist oppressive movements and all sorts of repressive situations can take their language from the oppressor, right? They have to try and reconfigure the language. That's one of the great things that the human mind can do. It can take what's running in at it and not merely be the passive receiver of it, but it can reconfigure it, re-endow it with meaning. And I think that's a really important thing for resistance movements to do. I'm going to give you one last comment, if you like.
For me?
Yeah, for you. We're about done, but I want to give you the last word.
I guess I just want to say that the most beautiful moments for me are the moments when the police actually lay down their arms. Like, that's the moment in Velvet Revolutions when everybody cries. Because we think we're living in a system in which police carry arms and they just use them, and they use them to stop revolutionary action. They use them to suppress dissent. But when the solidarity happens between police and the populace who is showing up to make its views known and to exercise its dissent, that's the beginning of a different order. That's when we see that systems that we thought were closed are actually more open. I don't know if we can... We do call that a revolution. It's a nonviolent revolution.
Well, Judith, this has been a great conversation. There's so much more we could talk about. There's so much more to say. But right now, I have to thank you for joining
us. Thank you.
Our guest has been Judith Butler, professor of comparative literature at UC Berkeley, prolific, influential author and thinker, wrote for the relevant to our discussion today, Interpreting Nonviolence. So, John, what are your thoughts now? What are you thinking?
Well, I think we got somewhere, particularly one of the later questioners. I'd like to see our stock of examples of successful nonviolence go up from these great, you know, things like ending the Raj in India or the civil rights movement, to lots of particular things in local communities where some kind of nonviolent protest worked. Cases where the vote doesn't work and op-eds don't work. This is, in America, we got freedom of assembly, we got freedom of speech. This is an option. Now, does it work? Does it work in the small cases? I think that's for a lot of interesting research.
I think that's a really important point, and it led me to a thought that I've never had, that we really should think about teaching engaged citizenry to our students in a way that doesn't just talk about politics and voting, but how citizens change their localities.
Well, your son Kiyoshi just organized a protest a little while ago. Now, did Los Altos High School help him figure out how to do that?
Yeah, there was a teacher, but that's a long story. We don't want to go into it. There was a teacher who helped the students out a lot. This conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is Cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore I blog. And you too can become a partner in that community by visiting our webpage, philosophytalk.org.
Now let's join a nonviolent movement for speed. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, when I read about nonviolent movements, I'm always struck by the fact that they are generally struggles to get what should have been just given in the first place. And they seldom end well, a violent end for both Dr. Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi. Despite the wishful thinking and outright denial of some in America, race is still an issue. And India is still in a turmoil-y kind of situation, especially with its former nation mate Pakistan. Gandhi started out as a lawyer and a would-be loyal British subject. He spent years in South Africa and was a stretcher-bearer during the Boer War. As a matter of fact, he and Winston Churchill were both present at the same battle, Gandhi to cart the bodies away and Churchill, I guess, to add them up. Later, of course, Gandhi wanted a free India and Churchill wanted a defeated Reich. Churchill won, but England took years to recover. Gandhi had his own beliefs about nonviolence, not defeating opponents, but weaning them from error. He did not consider it passive resistance. There was nothing passive about it. After Gandhi's death, George Orwell observed that, quote, inside the saint there was a very shrewd, able person who could have been a brilliant success as a lawyer, an administrator, or a businessman, unquote. Orwell also noted that Gandhi was actually rather ruthless, on himself anyway. No meat, no alcohol, no tobacco, no spices, no sex, no desire, no close friendship, no love. I don't think Americans ever grasped that part of it. In the nonviolent civil rights movement back in the 60s, there were many close friendships and many actual casualties. I always find it strange that hippies got to grab the peace-loving glory. It's a pallid imitation of true nonviolence, plus Haight-Ashbury gave birth to Charlie Manson. Woodstock had the seeds of Altamont. Pothead Laurel Canyon had the seeds of crackhead crime sprees. And the Eagles. Even there, a peaceful, easy feeling gave way to the bleakness of Hotel California. On the other hand, despite the strident promotion of guns in our culture and the constant banging on war drums, I find it amazing that more violence doesn't break out. But, you know, those 47 senators who sent the letter to Iran informing them that whatever treaty they come up with is automatically no good, so listen to us instead of the president, was that sedition or just a funny prank? Well, the jury's out. Think how much more effective that would have been if all 47 senators had stripped down to loincloths and sat down cross-legged right there in the chambers, vowing not to eat meat until all the Iranian-enriched uranium, every last ounce, is deposited right there in the Senate cloakroom. Well, we might have gotten someplace, don't you think? Namaste. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2015.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Special thanks to Stephanie Wiseman, Erica Sokolow-Shane, Truman Chen, Dan Brandon, Dominic Borg, and Crystal Nickerson.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Our marketing director is Dave Millar.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners in our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW, local public radio for San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed, or on occasion misexpressed, on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders. Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website. That's philosophytalk.org. There you can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you so much for listening.
And thank you for thinking.